All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I mean, you know, from yesterday. Welcome to the show. January 10th, 2014. I'm your host, Scott Horton. Appreciate you tuning in. Eric Margley is going to be on the show here today, and Sheldon Richmond, too. And yeah, I do have them on a lot because they know everything about everything that I'm interested in learning about, so. Also, I'm lazy. I need an intern or something. Anybody want to be my intern? Alright, well, anyway. Should be a good show for you. Sheldon Richmond, write about everything. And Eric Margulies, extremely knowledgeable about foreign affairs. Can't say I agree with him on everything. Sheldon Richmond is mathematically, factually, scientifically walking truth. That's what he is. He's the plumb line. He is libertarian analysis as applied to all things. Even Anthony Gregory, who is the most libertarian person in the history of the world, says that he's in Sheldon Richmondian. Oh, me, I'm a Richmondian, he says. There you go. That's what kind of libertarian Anthony Gregory is. All right, anyway. Plumb line. Sheldon Richmond is going to be on the show today, and it's going to be great. So tune in for that. Also, I'm going to drink Dr. Pepper and burp in your ear infrequently. But it will happen. All right. Okay, first subject on the show today is Amazon.com. What a great way to help support the show. You shop on Amazon anyway. All you do is bookmark scotthorton.org/Amazon. And then whenever you go to Amazon, you just hit that first. And I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon's end of the deal. ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Okay, next order of business. I think I want to start with the police state section today. Yeah, don't you worry, Rand Paul. We're going to get to you, dude, here in just a minute. Rand Paul. But first, I wanted to point to the heroic efforts of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at the Northwestern University School of Law. Robert L. Warden sent out an email this morning in regards to Dion Patrick, co-defendant of recently exonerated client Daniel Taylor, is the first exoneree of 2014. These are two of five who were sentenced to life behind bars for a double murder they had nothing to do with. And by the way, I'm trying to figure out a simple way to tell you how to sign up for this thing. I don't know. But the Center on Wrongful Convictions is law.northwestern.edu/CWC, Center for Wrongful Convictions, CWC. So law.northwestern.edu/CWC. They do great work. Perhaps you can figure out a way to help support it. Hey, what if it was you that the cops tortured into confessing? And then you had no ability to prove yourself innocent and get yourself out of prison without some law students to help get the work done and get you sprung. Think about that, having one life and having it wasted in a cage because a judge and a prosecutor and a jury all enter a conspiracy to lock you up for something you didn't do. Can you imagine that? Well, thank goodness we live in a world with the Center on Wrongful Convictions, as well as the Innocence Project and a few others like that. If you don't know what to do with your life, you're just kind of wasting away aimlessly, hey, maybe you should, you know, I don't know, work in the mailroom, do something for people who are wrongfully convicted. What about that? That sounds like a pretty good thing to do. Better than delivering pizzas or something, you know. Or, I don't know, delivering pizzas is actually a pretty good job. If you like driving. But anyway, I think it's important sometimes. I sound like a fool. I apologize in advance for today's show, or, well, partially the beginning of the way through it here. The Benadryl. It's got my brain not working right, but it's got my lungs and my throat and my nose working better, so I'm going to go ahead and go with the Benadryl. I'm probably going to sound like an idiot to you a lot today, but that's all right. I probably usually do anyway. I do think it's worthwhile to stop and go on a tangent and point out that, hey, if somebody doesn't do this work, it doesn't get done. And so, you know, maybe it should be you. I try not to do call to action stuff that often, but I just try to, you know, stop and remind you what you already know, that without the ACLU and Judicial Watch to sue the government all day, it doesn't get sued. And without the Innocence Project, Barry Scheck and the guys at the Innocence Project, and without Robert L. Warden and the people at the Center for Wrongful Convictions, these guys, people like Dion Patrick, rot in cages. Their entire human life stolen from them by the state. Rotting away, locked up like an animal. And with some people, at least, who actually deserve to be there, too. It's not a very nice place to have the government, you know, kidnap you and send you to. But anyway, the good news is, reported by Steve Mills in the Chicago Tribune, Cook County prosecutors have set aside the murder conviction and life sentence of a Chicago man half a year after freeing one of his co-defendants in a case that has been clouded by questionable confessions. Attorneys for Dion Patrick, 42, had been disappointed last month when prosecutors refused to ask Cook County Judge Jorge Alonso to throw out Patrick's conviction for a 1992 double murder on the north side. The attorneys had even packed their car with food for the approximately six-hour drive to the maximum security Maynard Correctional Center, the Southern Illinois prison where Patrick was serving his sentence. But on Friday morning, prosecutors finally reversed themselves and set aside the conviction and the sentence, or asked the judge to. Patrick was expected to be released from Maynard later today. Patrick is one of eight men who were charged with the November 1992 murders of Jeffrey Lassiter and Sharon Hugabrook. All eight confessed and implicated one another. Five of the eight were convicted and sent to prison. Three of them were life sentences. So even that's got to raise big questions for you right there. The whole story was that eight of them did it, but they could only get convictions against five of them in the first place. Well, the other three were in on it. How come you couldn't convict them? And then anyway, I'm going to skip to the end. Because the point is, he was locked up. How's this for an alibi? The night of the double murder in question, I was in the local lockup. Behind bars, kidnapped, imprisoned, like an animal. So I couldn't have possibly been in two places at once as part of an eight-man murder conspiracy, could I? They don't care. Prosecutors, they knew. This was his excuse all along. And they don't get into the story here about whether the jury ever was allowed to hear that evidence. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that the jury decided to just disregard it. That the jury knew, but they liked sentencing people and convicting them anyway, and so they do. That's the job of a jury, to go along with whatever the government wants. And so anyway, this guy was locked up at Town Hall Station. And of course, it was right there in the records the whole time. It's not like they didn't have paperwork. It's not like Mexico, where it was the cops who pulled him over, but nobody knows what happened after that. No, we know what happened after that. Everything was by the book. He was locked up at the time of the murder. Prosecutors prosecuted him anyway. And he says in here, and this sounds crazy, this sounds like you would never do this, but people do this a lot. He says the reason that he confessed to it was because the cops were parading all the other witnesses in there, into the interrogation room, and implying, at least, were, you know, asserting, making him believe that all these different people were pointing their fingers at him. So we're going to either give you the death penalty, or you're going to confess and point your fingers back at them too, and you'll all get life. So what would you do? I mean, it's easy to believe that you would just never confess to a crime you never committed, but if they're really, like, threatening you with the electric chair or the needle, people falsely confess all the time. Torture does work. People say whatever you want. And it doesn't have to be CIA style. It could be, you know, one degree torture. Chicago police torture.
Why does the U.S. support the torture dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Ah, geez, I forgot to sign in the chat room. Go to ScottHorton.org/chat. Make up a fake name, and then put in the CAPTCHA, and you're in. I can't read some of these CAPTCHAs, man. I gotta hit reload a few times on these CAPTCHAs. What the hell? I mean, I understand that they make them so that the computers can't read them, but what about me? Maybe I'm no smarter than a computer. Probably not. Your toe, Jackie, was the CAPTCHA for me. Your toe, Jackie. Suppose somebody could make some sense out of that. Anyway. So now I'm in the chat room. Hey, chat room guys. Man, it's hot in here. I mean in my office more than in your chat room, I guess. But you understand what I'm saying. It's freaking hot, dude. All right. So now Iraq, I don't want to talk too much about Iraq before Sheldon gets here. I'll tell you what, let's talk about Iran sanctions. So there's this piece by Colin H. Kahl, K-A-H-L, in the National Interest. He's got this piece, The Danger of New Iran Sanctions. And now let me tell you about this guy. He is, blam, he was the director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for New American Security. From 2009 to 2011, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. Huh. Now, the Center for New American Security, of course, you all remember, was set up by basically the Democrat hawks in time for Obama's election. That was basically what it is. It was set up to be his little PNAC, his separate PNAC. And this is where the counterinsurgency doctrine came from and everything. John Nagel and Michelle Flournoy and all those kooks. If you kill people just right, they fall in love with you. You just gotta, if you kill them just right, they love it. Is the counterinsurgency doctrine. It's really stupid. It's never worked anywhere, especially not in Iraq or Afghanistan. So this guy, Colin H. Kahl, in other words, must be a horrible, terrible person responsible for the deaths of uncountable innocents. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. Okay, but here is where cognitive dissonance comes into conflict with the confirmation bias in order to produce the statement that, look, even Colin H. Call, the Democrat hawk from the Center for a New American Security and the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, agrees with me. So that's the ultimate extra super proof that I'm right. Now, of course, if he disagreed with me, all of these things about him would be the proof of why you don't need to listen to him, only to me, because he's wrong about everything, because after all, he's the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. He's just trying to make up excuses to kill people. But in this case, he agrees with me. And so we're going to do confirmation bias to override cognitive dissonance, and we're going to go with even Colin H. Call says that the Senate better not pass these new Iran sanctions. That there's only one purpose in passing these Iran sanctions. In fact, that was Paul Pillar also writing at the National Interest. Stop lying and obfuscating and pretending that you're not trying to sabotage the nuclear deal. They keep saying, oh yeah, no, more sanctions will make the Iranians do what we want even more. No, they won't. And they're deliberately designed to sabotage the negotiations. Don't lie. The same sanctions have the terms that the deal must encompass. And they're all, of course, asking the impossible. Asking for a complete abolition of Iran's nuclear program, basically, which is, they know, not going to happen. And anyway, they got 58 signatures on it now. So it was Paul Pillar who actually... put his big John Hancock on the Iraq NIE of 2002 that lied you into war last time, was saying, hey, these sanctions are meant to sabotage the deal, and we should not pass them. Or at least, he was saying, we should at least be honest about what the purpose of the sanctions is. Don't say the sanctions are here to make the deal easier. What the hell is that? How are we even supposed to have a debate when the whole premise is dishonest? But then it's this guy, Colin H. Call, who is really proving the case beyond any doubt with 3,000 words or five here, the danger of new Iran sanctions. New Iran sanctions, that is the Menendez, Kirk, Schumer bill in the U.S. Senate. And they're working on the same thing in the House of Representatives right now as well. That this thing is designed beyond any doubt to sabotage the deal. And, oh, it's just a coincidence that it's the senators who are paid the most by the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee are the ones who are doing the most to try to sabotage the nuclear deal. And what's the nuclear deal? The nuclear deal is to take Iran's nuclear program that already isn't a weapons program, that already is harmless, that already is capital S safeguarded from here to the ends of eternity, and making it smaller, setting it back by great proportions. That's just the interim deal. Now, the final deal would obviously take the form of something like limited numbers of centrifuges producing enriched uranium at 3.5%, safeguarded by the IAEA, sign the additional protocol that allows for the IAEA to do more inspections than under a regular plain old safeguards agreement, and then we'll lift some sanctions and whatever. That would include probably closing Fordo, maybe making sure to internationalize the Bushehr reactor that the Russians have. I think the Russians already have a long-term deal to take care of any waste from their reactor. Maybe they could internationalize a little bit more of their program. Anyway, everybody already knows the contours of the deal. The basic outline of the deal is you go from verifying the peaceful intentions of your the peaceful nature of your nuclear program to extra double dog super duper verifying the same, and we'll lift some sanctions. That's the deal. There's nothing in there about, we'll make you our best friends in the world and put you on welfare and everything else. That's not in there. That's never going to be in there. And so, geez, why in the world would a bunch of people who put Israel first, who are the number one recipients of AIPAC money, why would they want to oppose the utter castration of Iran's nuclear program. Its diminishment to near nothing. If what they're so concerned about is a nuclear Iran that might ever attack Israel. Because, of course, that's not their concern. Their concern is whether Israel can get America to attack Iran. And if America has a nuclear deal with Iran, well, that's the number one excuse to attack them. It's not that the Israelis fear first strike from Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu and Ehud Barak themselves both told Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic magazine. If you don't know who that is, he's a former Israeli prison guard in the occupied territories who now writes lies about why you ought to invade Iraq in The New Yorker and why you ought to invade everybody else now in The Atlantic since then. Who's just a horrible... He might as well be Netanyahu's left hand writing in the Atlantic. And Netanyahu and Barak both told him, oh, no, we don't think Iran would ever shoot us with a nuclear bomb if they had one. They wouldn't. Nah, they wouldn't. What, we'd nuke the hell out of them. They're not stupid. Really? Boy, be careful how loud you say that, Mr. Prime Minister, because the rubes are under the impression that that's the big deal here, is that if Iran had a nuke, they would use it on Israel. Thanks for clearing that up for us. You can read it from the 2010 interview with Barak and Netanyahu both by Jeffrey Goldberg. Where they say, oh, existential threat. Yeah, by that we mean there's a possible brain drain where talented Israelis might go to America for grad school and then they might stay in America instead of come home if they're afraid that, you know, their country might ever start a war with somebody who has the capability of fighting back at all. Or, you know, it could help to give Hezbollah, in fact, I didn't even say that, it would limit our freedom of action in the region. And that's how they talked to Jeffrey Goldberg. Forgetting that this is an article for people to read. That they don't say this will give Hezbollah freedom of action. They say this will limit our freedom of action in the region. If we just have to take into account the fact that Iran had a single nuke, if they had a single nuke. So. But their position remains, as Michael Adeen explained, everybody knows. I think he's an authoritative source on this. Netanyahu's policy is to try to get America to attack Iran for him. He can't do it. His Air Force has told him what we really need is American heavy bombers. And you know who has those? Americans. So they'd rather do that. You know, that way they don't have their freedom of action in the region limited. But anyway... So, that's what's going on here. 58 senators. It's the Nuclear Weapon-Free Iran Act of 2013. Menendez, sponsored by Menendez. And it's in the Hill today that Rand Paul. Yeah, right, Ron Paul. Rand Paul won't rule out sanctions vote. We'll see what he does. Oh, you can trust Rand, said no one ever. Not even me just now. All right, Eric Margolies here in a sec.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and hey, look, it's Eric Margolies, our good friend. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Scott.
That's very good. Very happy to have you here, everybody. Y'all know ericmargulies.com is the website. He's also writing regularly at lourockwell.com and at unz.com. That's UNZ.com. And he's author of the books War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And I actually want to, I want to talk to you about a bunch of stuff today. But I want to start with recent article here at ericmargulies.com, World Danger Spots 2014, that starts with, as you call it, mostly forgotten, but the highly dangerous Indian-controlled portion of disputed Kashmir. And, you know, one thing that I learned about the India-Pakistan standoff over Kashmir in the last couple of years, I guess, was about this study that Daniel Ellsberg pointed out. This study that says even if there was a very limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, where they didn't even use all their arsenals, and then never even mind whether China would be brought in or not, and these kinds of questions, that just a very limited nuclear exchange between the two countries there could eventually kill billions of people. That could be enough to cause a severe enough nuclear winter as to cause, you know, massive proportions of the world's crops to fail and massive starvation and war and upheaval and tumult for centuries to come, you know, coming out of something like that. And then, yet, as you say, it's mostly forgotten. Hardly anyone ever talks about Kashmir ever, and they certainly don't talk like, yeah, we need to make sure to have a peace summit and solve these difficulties or anything like that. So give us the lowdown, because I don't want to see humankind extinct over, you know, some nonsense. And truth will get us part of the way to solving the problem.
We worry about countries like Iran that have no nuclear weapons, and yet we completely ignore the very dangerous nuclear standoff between India and Pakistan. In my book, War at the Top of the World, which has come out, I think, in four editions, which is about this very subject, and it came out almost 20 years ago now, I cite a RAND Corporation, that's a U.S. military think tank, RAND Corporation, study that a very limited nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan would immediately kill 2 million people, would end up gravely injuring or killing up to 100 million. This is just in India and Pakistan, and send radioactive dust around the globe that you just referred to as a nuclear winter, and also pollute all the groundwater and rainwater upon which 1.6, 1.7 billion Indians and Pakistanis live. So even a limited war would be a terrible catastrophe. But the ingredients are all there, and it could happen tomorrow.
Now, I have a dream that one day America, the nation state, which I can't make it go away, but if I can't make it go away, I have a dream that one day it would live up to its creed and it would have no overseas forces anywhere other than diplomats, and they would do things like hold summits in third countries, fourth countries that have nothing to do with any of these conflicts, and just try to work it out. And I don't mean by offering each side $3 billion a year from now on and that kind of thing either, but just there's got to be a solution. I actually one time had software engineers in my cab, one Indian and one Pakistani. And I said, come on, guys, can't we work out this Kashmir thing? And they both were like, yes, of course we can work this out. This is just stupid politicians don't want to work it out.
Well, it's complicated, Scott. I really didn't give you the background on it. But when the British divided India in 1947, the western regions, which were predominantly Pakistani, wanted their own separate state, Pakistan. But the independent mountain state of Kashmir, which was ruled by a Hindu Maharaja, but mostly about 70-80% Muslim people, voted after lots of exchange of money and heavy persuasion from Nehru, the Indian prime minister, to go to join India. Riots erupted amongst the Muslims. The Indians and Pakistanis, or the Pakistanis and the Indians, rushed up troops, and the fighting ensued. And at the end of the fighting, the state of Kashmir was left divided, two-thirds ruled by India, one-third by Pakistan. The Kashmiri Muslims have been rebelling on and off against Indian rule ever since. Fighting now goes on, but the Indians call it terrorism, cross-border terrorism. The Pakistanis call it liberation. I've been there with the Pakistani guerrillas going across the border into Indian-ruled Kashmir. It's a bloody war. Somewhere, we don't know, 60, 70, 80,000 people have died. Indian repression in its portion of Kashmir has been extremely brutal, marked by torture and mass punishments of villages and executions of people. Human rights groups in India have denounced the government there. And this thing drags on and on. The problem is that the Indian army is poised on the border there. There's fighting a couple of times a week. I've been under fire in Kashmir on the ceasefire line known as the line of control. And the Pakistanis army is drawn up there. They're pistol shots away from each other. And now the two sides both have nuclear weapons and the bombs on aircraft and missiles armed with nuclear warheads pointed at each other. And their early warning system gives them only 3 to 4 minutes a warning. So they're on a hair trigger, early warning alert. You have a part of the world where the phones don't work and the trains don't work and not much else works properly, and yet their early warning system is set. Just one false report could trigger a nuclear exchange because it's the use them or lose them threat that we sometimes saw during back in the Cold War days.
Uh-huh. You know, I just read this thing, and now I thought it was in foreignpolicy.com, but now I can't find it. But it was about how the Pakistani general in charge of their nukes, that he's a world-renowned guy for being just ultra-competent, and that, man, if the Pakistanis are going to have nukes, at least General What's-His-Name is the one in charge of them. And but now he's gone, and everybody's scared as hell, because even under him, it was a situation where, you know, like you're saying, that a lot of the way a lot of people live, and you're talking dirt roads, you're talking nukes in the back of flatbed trucks stuck in traffic, you know, with everybody else. Talking about very low-tech command and control over these nukes. And I remember in 98 when they were testing them, one Pakistani general telling the CNN cameraman to tell the Indians, "We're not afraid of you. Bring it on. Atom bombs don't scare us." like they're meant to just scare you to death.
Well, you know, fortunately, both the Indian and Pakistani generals are pretty conservative and level-headed bunch. They are not wild-eyed fanatics. They're very aware of the dangers that they have. The Indian Command and Control Authority is run through the civilian upper echelons of the government, which gives it even more, let's say, pause period in the event of a crisis, where the Pakistani generals can probably trigger a nuclear attack if the prime minister backs them. But it's, you know, its problem is in a crisis or a huge bombing or a major terrorist incident, like we've seen, for example, in Bombay, people's good sense quickly evaporates.
Right. All right, and now, so if I'm President Horton and I send you a special envoy, Margulies, over there, what would you have to honestly arrange for the Indians to make it okay for them to give up their control, or, you know, at least, I don't know, one of the two-thirds they control or something to help heal these wounds and move forward from here?
Mr. President, the United Nations has called for a plebiscite in the Indian-ruled portion of Kashmir since 1948. The Indians have refused. They won't allow the people there to vote. They know perfectly well that the people there will probably vote to join Pakistan, even though India is now comparatively booming, and Pakistan is a big, fat mess. Still, they would probably join, because there's this deep cultural, religious enmity between Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs. But what the United States has completely avoided the issue, but what we should be doing is really pressing the two sides very hard to come to some kind of diplomatic settlement. And really what this should be based on is the integration of the two Kashmirs, Indian and Pakistani side, erase the border between them, make it a demilitarized state.
Mm-hmm. Kind of semi-autonomous zone or something.
That's right. That seems a clear way, but India won't do it. And then there's another...
Well, what if we sent Condoleezza Rice over there to give them more nuclear weapons technology? Would they do the same?
God help us. But there are more issues that cloud it. Number one, the Pakistanis gave a big chunk of plateau around 14,000 feet altitude called Aksai Chin to China, close ally of Pakistan, so the Chinese could build a road there that links Tibet with Xinjiang, or Xinjiang province. So that was part of Kashmir. Ladakh, Indian-ruled Ladakh, was sometimes called Little Tibet, was also part of Kashmir. Those have to be resolved. Then there's the all of the northern province of Baltistan, where the mountain climbing expeditions go to K2, for example, were also historically part of Kashmir. So the Indians are saying, oh, you have to give it back, too. If we have anything up, you Pakistanis have to give up the north of Pakistan. The Pakistanis say, oh, no. So there are deep complexities there, very hard to untangle. The most important question is to get both sides to detarget their nuclear weapons.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Let's start with baby steps here, you know? All right. Everybody hang tight. We got to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Eric Margolese. EricMargolese.com is his website, spelled like Margolis. EricMargolese.com, World Danger Hotspots 2014. The books are American Raj and War at the Top of the World, and the brand new one running at LRC tomorrow is Al-Qaeda Just Won't Go Away. We're going to ask him about that right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I think I need to divvy up the commercials better than I have them. And well, next week, this weekend, I'll get it all fixed up for you. New spots and everything. All right. By the way, that footnote that I couldn't remember or find, it's one more reason to worry about Pakistan's nukes. It's in the nationalinterest.org by Michael Kugelman.
talking about this general who's now retired and been replaced and whatever. Anyway, so now, yeah, we're talking with Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com. And I wanted to ask him, sorry, I meant to ask you before we went on the air, Eric, whether you had seen this article in Foreign Policy Today by Yochai Driesen. Gates, U.S. tried to oust Karzai in failed putsch. And this is about how they tried to rig the election for Abdullah Abdullah back in 2009 in the fall. Remember that?
Well, I do remember it. I haven't seen the article to which you refer, but I know that the U.S. have written many times that the U.S. rigged the elections, all the elections in Afghanistan, and they rigged them much more crudely than even the Soviets did.
Yeah, I mean, they failed miserably then, and it couldn't have been more obvious when the New York Times is running front page stories saying CIA agent Karzai's brother is a heroin dealer. Really? And that's how you discredit him, huh? Is that you're accusing him of being a CIA agent, or you're accusing him of being a heroin dealer?
That's right.
You know,
pretty sorted.
And then I don't know about Abdullah Abdullah. Do you know much about him?
Yes, he is a very, you know, I have an old saying, beware any Afghan who speaks flawless English and wears a well-tailored suit.
Yeah.
Because they're always the CIA boys and or crooks. And Abdullah Abdullah, one of the more intelligent, better spoken of the Afghan senior people, was a leading member of the Northern Alliance. That was founded by Ahmed Shah Massoud, and the Northern Alliance, a Tajik group that is very close to the Russians, was more or less managed by the KGB, and during the whole Afghan war against the Soviets, sided and fought with the Soviets to undermine the U.S.-backed Afghan resistance. And now they're the biggest heroin and opium dealers in Afghanistan. This Northern Alliance was a close American ally. With them, we overthrew the Taliban government in Kabul. So, but he's the nice, soft-spoken corporate face of these thugs and drug-dealing warlords from the north.
Mm-hmm. So these weren't the guys who were outright fighting on the side of the communists back in the 80s. They were the fake opposition.
That's right. They claimed to be fighting, but they actually weren't. Huh. Fighting the Soviets, they were not.
Right. And then, boy, I mean, they really botched that thing, right? If they couldn't, why couldn't they install him in power? They were outmatched by Karzai, the CIA was?
Well, the Taliban, the CIA, suddenly got frightened when they realized that the Northern Alliance was completely run by the KGB and very close to the Russians.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm talking about in 2009. When they were trying to rig the election for Abdullah Abdullah against Karzai, and then they gave up, basically.
I think it was a combination of poorly rigging the election, and maybe they ran out of money, who knows, or poorly running the election, rigging the election, and also there was great resistance in amongst the Pashtuns, who still make up the majority there, to sort of see the CIA pulling all the strings. Anyway, they didn't succeed, and they were unsure about who to put in his place.
Yeah. Well, the way that Gates is portraying it in his new memoir, apparently, is that this was all Richard Holbrooke's idea, and he tried to stop him, and yeah, right, you know.
I take what Gates says with a couple of grains of salt. He doesn't have an illustrious record either, and was more of a politician than a strategist.
Yeah, yeah, from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Too, yeah. Of his career, I mean. Not just his beginning of the Afghan war, his role in the Afghan war, or anything like that.
So there's this
new NIE that says that if we leave, everything will fall apart. So does that mean we got to stay?
Well, that's the standard colonial response. The Soviets used to say, I remember vividly when I was in the Caucasus in the 1980s, if we leave, they're going to be at each other's throats. We, the Soviet Union, is the only thing that's kept the peace here. Well, now we Americans are using the exact same argument. I suppose it's true. If you keep a colonial garrison large enough to be effective in Afghanistan, or Iraq for that matter, eventually it will sort of help keep the peace the way the British did. But Do we want to be there for the next 20 years? The Afghans are not going to help us do it. They're going to be sniping away at us. And it's, you know, garrisoning Afghanistan is extraordinarily expensive. So it's like keeping a garrison on the dark side of the moon. Very hard, very expensive.
Yeah, and I mean, the excuse that we have to stay to keep things the way we've set them up is sort of the same thing as saying we've set things up in a completely untenable house of cards kind of a way. And so, you know, what kind of, how's it a mission worth preserving if by definition it's a failure?
Well, you know my hackles raise even every time I hear the word mission. We're on a mission to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan. Mission. Mission is something like you go on like a humanitarian mission to save starving people in Uganda or something like that. Invading Afghanistan is not a mission. It's an imperial adventure. Same thing with Iraq. And the question is, why are we still there? What do we hope to achieve? And
that is the question.
That's the debate in Washington. The Pentagon can't admit defeat. I mean, you know, first they got their pants kicked in Vietnam when I was in the Army, and then the idea that a bunch of poorly armed, lightly armed mountain tribesmen have defeated the most powerful military force on Earth with all the Flash Gordon weapons that we have is just very hard to take for the Pentagon. The Pentagon knows that if it retreats from Afghanistan, there are going to be howls from Congress to cut the defense budget. So
that's the mission, is having a mission, finding something to do.
That's right. And so the counterargument is, well, the U.S. must stay there to prevent the Chinese from taking over. Well, the Chinese aren't very anxious to get in there. The people who are really looking at Afghanistan now are the Indians. And there's been on and off talk about the U.S. and India collaborating to bring in Indian troops, but the Indians are too smart to do that too. They're doing a lot of stuff, but it doesn't involve military adventures. Finally, the U.S. wants a garrison. You know, I keep saying we Americans react to oil like cats to my cats do to catnip. We just love that oil, and wherever there's oil, there are Americans. Look, for God's sakes, why are American troops now? Today we read that American troops are going into Somalia. Again, small numbers. There are American special forces in Uganda. Why did we just create this miserable little state of South Sudan? Well, it's a big state. Why are we interested in Uganda, of all places? Well, because they've all got oil. And where there's oil, we have interest. So that's another reason to keep a garrison in Afghanistan overwatching the great Caspian oil basin.
Yeah, you know, that just doesn't make any sense. There's not going to be security enough to run a pipeline through Afghanistan for 100 years. What are we talking about here?
They couldn't even get them out of Iraq. The resistance kept blowing them up. So, but it's what the French call an idée fixe. You know, it's become a mantra for the U.S. We've got to stay. We've got to maintain stability. You know, we've got to protect women and children and all this kind of BS while we're bombing them every day.
Yeah.
It makes sense to the American imperial establishment.
Right.
It doesn't make sense
as a jobs program, basically.
That's right. It doesn't make sense to ordinary people like me.
Yeah, or me. Although I'm not sure how ordinary I am, but I think I am.
Extraordinary.
I think I'm the standard of what ordinary should be. How about that?
Well, quite right, quite right.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of dead bodies for nothing. I mean, and then when it comes to the so-called mission, occupying and invading the place, and, you know, you mentioned, like, women's rights and all that. They never really do claim, even at the dawn of the surge and all the counterinsurgency doctrine hype and all that, they never really said, yes, we'll have a Western European-style Westphalian nation state that's going to be our permanent ally from now on after this or anything like that. They just said, well, it'll be a little better or something.
A lot of Americans, particularly women, believe that great progress has been made to protect Afghan women. Meanwhile, every day, horror stories about abuse of women are coming out of India And nobody pays such close attention. But, oh, Taliban, wife beaters, killers of little girls.
Be careful.
That's still...
We'll be occupying the subcontinent next, Eric. We don't want that.
The subcontinent may be occupying us.
Oh, well, I'll look forward to that, actually, I think. All right. Thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Cheers to you, Scott. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. That's the great Eric Margulies. EricMargulies.com. No, I don't want the Indians to occupy North America, but I don't want America to either. All right. We'll be right back with more complaining by me and more interviews of interesting people, too, after this.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and man, I should have had Jim Loeb on the show today. I considered calling him, but I know he doesn't really like doing radio. But man, this is a really important one. I should have had him on to talk about this. At Loeblog.com, Loeblog.com, neocons who brought you the Iraq War endorse AIPAC's Iran bill. This goes back to those sanctions I was talking about a minute ago, meant to sabotage the Iranian nuclear deal. The Neoconservative Foreign Policy Initiative, FPI, the successor organization of the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, has just published another open letter to congressional leaders that implicitly endorses what I have called, that's Loeb talking, the Kirk Menendez Wag the Dog Act of 2013, known officially as the Nuclear Weapon Free Act of 2013. I say implicitly because it doesn't come right out and urge support for this specific bill, which AIPAC and the Israel lobby, for which AIPAC is the vanguard, are flogging as hard as they possibly can. But the intention is pretty clear. This letter, like PNAC, FBI is essentially a letterhead organization that issues manifestos rather than a real think tank or grassroots membership organization, was signed by 72 former, and I don't know why he hadn't mentioned Bill Kristol yet. I'm sure Bill Kristol, we get to him in paragraph 3, but I'll go ahead and mention him now. Yeah, this is his thing. He's the ringleader of all this, and that's his brilliance, is how to have your lawyer set up 15 different things and call them think tanks and issue memoranda and pretend like there's some kind of constituency, when it's just an echo chamber of the same jerk over and over and over again. The Cheshire Cat himself, Irvin Kristol's son. Anyway. This letter has been signed by 72, quote, former U.S. government officials and foreign policy experts, the vast majority of whom are easily identified as neoconservatives, as opposed to, quote, conservatives, the highly questionable term used by the Daily Beast's Josh Rogan, who reported on the letter even before it was published on the FBI website to describe the signatories. One wonders whether Rogan was given the letter on the condition that the authors be described as conservatives rather than neoconservatives, which has become something of a dirty word over the past decade due to its association with the Iraq War and their enthusiasm over other ill-advised military adventures. That's a good question. And, you know, the other thing that it accomplishes, too, is to just sort of subtly reinforce, without making an argument, but just to reinforce the idea that to be a conservative means to be a hawk. But you could just as easily see those two things as contradictory, couldn't you? What's so conservative about world revolution all the time anyway, huh? What's so conservative about spending unending piles of trillions of dollars on militarism? Shocking your society from time to time with these traumas. None of that's conservative. Look at family life for the average American soldier right now and tell me how conservative that is. Anyway, and Josh Rogan knows better, too. Come on. The difference between somebody who's a right-wing nationalist, who's a born Reaganite or something, versus someone who's a former social democrat, a former worshiper of Leon Trotsky, the founder of the Red Army, a former disciple of Leon Wolfstetter and Leo Strauss and other former commies like them, who then became Reaganites. There's a difference. So anyway, I'll go back to reading Jim Loeb here, sorry. Of the 72, that's Jim Loeb writing here, counted at least 25 who in the past had signed PNAC letters, most of them dealing with Iraq and the Middle East, dating back to its founding in 1997 by Robert Kagan and Bill Kristol, to its unceremonious demise in 2005. Kagan and Kristol also co-founded the FBI with Dan Senor 2 years later during Bush's second term, when most of the neocons who championed the Iraq War had either left the administration or been successfully marginalized by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Pentagon Chief Bob Gates. Among them are stalwarts from the American... That may be a bit overstated, but anyway. Among them are stalwarts from the American Enterprise Institute, such as Danielle Pletka, Michael Rubin, Fred Kagan, Gary Schmidt, and now Joe Lieberman, which acted as a kind of annex to Douglas Feith's Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon, that's the AEI he's referring to, in the run-up to and the immediate aftermath of the Iraq invasion. Of course, Danielle Pletka was, aside from Richard Perle, she would have been the number one promoter of Ahmed Chalabi in the entire time leading up to that war, and in fact, even after the CIA and the military turned on him. She was defending him and talking about what a great guy he was. Ahmed Chalabi, the Iranian spy, who, well, at least the CIA and the DIA say they think that Khomeini sent him to lie the neocons into war because they're so stupid and everything, you know? They'll do it. And then, yeah, Fat Neck Fred is on there, of course. And Doug Feith, who led the Office of Special Plans, which, you know what? Do yourself a favor. Time... And Google algorithms have done us a favor here. The wheat and the chaff have been pretty separated. If you were just to search the innocuous-sounding phrase, Office of Special Plans, your entire first page of Google results will be awesome. You'll find Jim Loeb, and you'll find Bob Dreyfus and Jason Vest. You'll find Karen Kotowski. You'll find Seymour Hersh. And who am I missing? Couple others. Anyway, good stuff once you start reading about the Office of Special Plans and how they quite deliberately lied you into war with Iraq 10 years ago. Other signatories to this new letter pushing the Iran nuclear deal killing sanctions bill are Joshua Muravchik, who wrote Bomb Iran for the LA Times a couple of years back, Ruhul Mark Garek, who also championed the Iraq debacle, but who Michael Ledeen has since moved to the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a seemingly Likudist front that has increasingly partnered events, letters, and policy papers with the Foreign Policy Initiative. FDD signatories include, and by the way, they moved to the Foundation for Defense of Democracies because Danielle Pletka fired them. Michael Ledeen especially was too much of a liability for AEI anymore. It was time to relegate him to the lower ranks of the neocons. We can go pal around with Cliff May and Frank Gaffney and pond scum like that. Not invited to the fancy cocktail parties, not least for a little while. Bring too much bad publicity. Mark Dubowitz... John Hanna, who served as Dick Cheney's national security advisor during Bush's second term after the departure of Scooter Libby, is also a part of this. And there's a group from the Hudson Institute, Ken Weinstein, Seth Cropsey, Jack David Lee Smith, and Douglas Feith himself. I don't know most of those guys except Doug Feith. Not that I know him, but, you know, of them. Anyway, as former Bush officials, there are plenty. Elliot Abrams and his deputy on the National Security Council, Michael Duran, Feith and his successor, Eric Edelman, as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Jerry Bremer is on there, the Viceroy of Iraq. Robert Joseph, Dov Zakheim, Stephen Rademacher, who is married to Danielle Plitka, and he's the guy who was always trying to undermine the International Atomic Energy Agency Safeguards Review Conference thing. He was the one always trying to change the rules just to, you know, construct them in such a way that Iran would be in violation of them back then. Anyway, let's see. Michael Makovsky, who had been, he was from the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and I believe he was the partner. He was one of the couple of guys that Feith had running what was called the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group. Boring, right? Except, yeah, that's where they were making up lies about Saddam and Osama being one and the same, or best friends, or whatever lie. For Bush's consumption and for yours back then. And anyway, so there you go. In case there was any question about whether these sanctions are meant to help Obama to make a deal with Iran, because, after all, sanctions brought Iran to this point because they're at this point where they're willing to deal with us, and we had sanctions in the past, and so therefore ipso equals post facto and all that crap. And so all we need now is more. Apparently it's the magic elixir for getting Iran to do what you want without any further explanation than that. And yet, the official position of the CIA and America's intelligence agencies, as well as common sense for any honest person on the planet, is that evil men are doing this because they're trying to destroy the deal. And they're lying about their motives because they're liars, just like when they lie about all the other things that they say too. I mean, right? Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And Gareth's got a brand new one out. Gates conceals the real story of the gaming of Obama on the Afghan war. Of course, we all know the story because we talked about it with Gareth at the time. How... It's just like I was just saying, it was overstated about Gates sidelining the neocons. Gates was the one who implemented what they wanted to do. Rumsfeld wanted out of Iraq. It was Fat Neck Fred Kagan, Robert Kagan's little brother, and the other guys at the American Enterprise Institute that came up with the whole double down and blame everything on Iran strategy for 2007. Remember Jim Baker and Sandra Day O'Connor, and the leading lights of the old establishment did their Iraq study group and said, we ought to be out. This was in November of 06. So we ought to be out by the spring of 08. And Bush said the same thing he'd been telling Baker all along, which was, forget you, Dad. And went with Fat Neck Fred and the double down game. And that's why they brought in Gates. Because Donald Rumsfeld didn't want to go along with that. Robert Gates was willing to do it, so they brought in Bush Sr.'s old guy to put the realist face on the neocon policy. Ain't that fun? Anyway, that was when I first met Gareth, too. That was when I first started talking to him. It was January 07, when they were just starting with that nonsense. And good old Gareth has been telling it straight since then. Same kind of thing with Obama on Afghanistan in 2009, where Robert Gates is the one carrying the water for the neocons. And, I mean, what does it mean when he says Obama doesn't believe in the mission? Well, what about you, dude? You believed in the mission? And then what was that mission? Because I'm siding with Eric Margulies here. I don't see the occupation of Afghanistan for no good reason itself to be a mission. A mission, he said it has to be a humanitarian thing. You could go on a mission to, like, go out and
seek and destroy a group of Taliban or something, but if it has no context that makes any sense, there's no larger mission or set of accomplishable goals to accomplish other than staying, well, then doesn't seem like it's worth sending guys on all those smaller missions where they gotta, you know, maybe die out there in the middle of, you know, killing people out there. You try to figure out a reason for them to be there in the first place. But without having read Gareth Porter's new article yet, the simple fact is, when General Petraeus and Stanley McChrystal were talking mad smack about their commander-in-chief in public, never mind all the stuff they told Michael Hastings, in public, in the fall of 2009, they were openly criticizing the president for not having decided yet to give them another 30,000 troops, even after he'd already given them 60,000 more. Oh, he's dithering, and he just won't. I forgot McChrystal's exact words, but McChrystal was giving the Republicans all the words. All they had to do was go, even Stanley McChrystal is criticizing the president for not hurrying up and making up his mind and whatever. Now, where was Robert Gates during all of that? We don't know, fly on the wall. Maybe somebody does, and they published it, and I don't know if I ever read any anecdotes of real inside conversations during that time. But one thing is for sure, that Robert Gates was not out there defending the president from this insubordinate attack from his subordinates. He didn't immediately put them in check. And he must have been part of the pressure to get him to go ahead and sign on to the surge. And after all, that's why Obama kept him anyway. Obama may not have believed in the mission. He might have known better all along, but he decided back in 2007, when he first started running for president, that there's no way he was going to run against both wars. He had to spin Afghanistan and then on into Pakistan as the good war, the legit war, the war we must win against the terrorists and all of that. Iraq is the distraction war, but Afghanistan is the good one. So, you know, Obama, then again, it's not, you know, he didn't completely box himself in. And it's true that he's still the president. You know, as much as I like blaming Cheney for the Bush years, Bush was the one in the chair. And yeah, there's an entire national security state that has all of its own motivations out there and whatever, but start firing people then. If you're the president, that's your job, is to, you know, do that then. There's no actual thing in the world forcing President Obama to go along with the counterinsurgency doctrine nonsense and the surge into Afghanistan and the prolonging of that war all this time. He could have ended it a long time ago, and he could have won any public argument about it with his political opponents. No problem, hands down, too. Yeah, you millionaire Republicans in the House of Representatives want a war so bad over there, you go fight it. Say that once and see how many of their big, fat-ass, millionaire, bald-headed, soft-handed, lazy Vietnam War draft dodger Republican congressmen go and volunteer. None. Everybody has known all along what a stupid war this is. So, it was just politics. And you know what, too? David Rothkopp, the publisher of foreignpolicy.com, Foreign Policy Magazine, he wrote a piece with all his inside sources that say it was simply a political decision inside the White House that we can't take the risk of ending two wars and having the Republicans call us sissy pants. That's it. We'll be attacked from the right by the Hawks, and we can't have it. And so we have to have one war, at least. And so that was it. And then, like I told you yesterday and a million times before that, they wrote it up in the Washington Post, excerpts from Little America, where the CIA had produced a report by the fall of 2009 saying the surge of earlier this year has accomplished nothing and there's no point in continuing on with it anymore because it's not going to accomplish anything. And he knew it said that. The president knew the CIA report said that, and he deliberately refused to read that. How do you like that for plausible deniability? Oops, story got out. In fact, that was the first time we heard of that CIA report, was the anecdote that, yeah, there was a CIA report that Obama refused to read because it told him, don't bother, it's not going to work, don't do it. You'll be getting Ahmed and Johnny killed for nothing at all, except your fear of Republicans calling you fearful. God, I hate the Democrats. Aren't they horrible? God, they're horrible. You imagine if you were some kind of true believer guy and that was your boy that died over there or something? I mean, hell, you could be anti-war and have your son join up. You imagine whoever you are and your son goes and gets killed over in Afghanistan. And all along you know that Obama and the Secretary of Defense and all the chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all the rest of the leaders all knew better all along but did it anyway for politics. That the only thing that they had to sell as the end state of their mission was a government in a box and a changed society and all this ridiculous cartoon stuff where, you know, they'd never even finished a single project out there. Never did anything but kill people and get killed and lose. And just like if we were doing this exact segment 6-7 years ago, the Taliban still rules the whole country at night. They haven't accomplished anything. There's no Afghan army that they've trained up that exists without them. There's no Afghan police that they've trained up other than the local auxiliaries of the local warlords that we've hired. But in other words, they're already the local toughs of the local warlords anyway. Whole thing is crazy, dude. And, you know, I saw on CNN this morning, they had a foreign secretary type guy on there talking about Iraq. And Christian Amanpour is saying, well, geez, if things are bad in Iraq now, then that proves that we never should have left, right? And she seemed to really believe that. And he says, no, because see, what we were doing was we were propping up, these aren't his exact words or his accent either, but he was, I'm trying to remember his name. But he was the foreign minister under Tony Blair during the Iraq War. And he's saying, you know, basically what we were doing was we were propping up a situation that was untenable. And so the deal is, once we pull out, yeah, things have got to sift and work themselves out. And in some cases, that'll be violent. In some cases, people will be able to come up with compromises. But as long as we're there, at that point, we're actually preventing the settling of the conflicts one way or the other. And so if we'd stayed another 15 years, we may have prolonged it. Of course, neither of them are acknowledging it was the invasion and the occupation that caused all the violence and civil war and all the rest of it in the first place. The entire policy of Paul Bremer and of writing the Constitution and all the rest of it is what caused it all. But even then, maybe we'd be able to prop up a certain situation one way or the other. But even if we do that and stay another 10, 15, 20 years and then leave, it'll still have to sift itself and work itself out because it's an untenable thing, you know, which is, of course, exactly right. And which is, of course, exactly what everybody who was not in on it was saying all along. You know? I mean, you could say that they stuck with it long enough to put in power a government that could have never been put in power without the entire sectarian cleansing of Baghdad. So they, I guess you could say, mission accomplished. If the mission was ever stated as the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad and the final victory of the Shiite Arabs. But I don't think that's exactly what they're trying to do. I don't think they even knew. But anyway, same thing in Afghanistan. You're propping up power that can't survive in this form. You might as well quit now. And yeah, it'll be a mess, just like leaving Vietnam was a mess, but it's better than staying and it being a mess later and a mess in the meantime too.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it, but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here.
All right, y'all. Sorry for all the incoherent rambling on the show today. Probably doesn't sound much different to most of y'all, but for anybody who doesn't like it, I'm blaming the Benadryl. It's weird, this Benadryl. It's got me high in a way where I don't feel high, but then I think back on the things I was just saying, and I realize that there's something wrong with me. Very strange, this Benadryl. Maybe you're not supposed to take it first thing in the morning with coffee. Maybe that's the problem. I don't know. Anyway, so it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And in the next segment, I'm going to do my best to be quiet and let Sheldon Richmond say great stuff. Hey, Sheldon, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show.
I am doing fine, and always great to be with you. Thanks for asking me.
Good times. Very happy to have you here. Sheldon Richmond, everybody, you know him. He's the vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. And your latest piece here is U.S. foreign policy is a shambles. And sorry for wasting your time, but let's start with a shambles. Isn't that a singular and a plural all mixed together and confusing my brain?
Well, that wasn't a question I was prepared for.
Is that the proper grammar there? A shambles?
Yeah,
it's not in shambles?
I think you can say in shambles, too. But I don't think you can say is a shamble. I'm not sure there's such a thing as a shamble. But I'll have to defer to linguists on this one.
Yeah. I need to get, like, the great book of etymology. I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
I'm sure there are more than one.
Yeah, there you go. Just make sure to go to the Scott Horton link to Amazon.com first, everybody, before you send me your gift. All right. So, U.S. foreign policy is in shambles. It's a shambles. I like a shambles. It's a shambles. That makes sense. As after it goes to shambles, then it's in shambles. It's a shambles. In shambles. You bring up the point, the all-important point, that John McCain and Lindsey Graham are lamenting that the Americans are not in the middle of the fight going on in Fallujah right now.
Yeah, they are. They're very upset that there's been this resurgence of Al Qaeda and Sunni activity and violence in Anbar province, which is the Sunni part of Iraq. And while you know, I heard after I wrote this, after it was published, I did see McCain on TV saying, "Well, I'm not saying we should send in troops, because the American people wouldn't stand for that." That seems to be his only reason. I think he'd like to send the troops. Of course, he's sorry troops left. And he doesn't even buy the point that Obama tried hard to have the troops remain there. It's just that Maliki wouldn't give them immunity from Iraqi law, and which led to the final withdrawal of the troops. But McCain doesn't buy that. He wants to be able to blame Obama and say Obama didn't try hard enough to keep troops there. But, you know, like I say in the piece, he and Graham have never seen an opportunity for U.S. intervention that they didn't like.
Well, you got that right. By the way, Nick sends the grammar errors, and it turns out that you're right and that it's supposed to be a shambles, and I'm wrong that it could ever be in shambles. That is incorrect way to use that term entirely, it says here on this anonymous website.
I'd have to look that up. I thought you could say that, but I'd have to look that one up. I'm glad I guessed and got it right.
It's only your way, never the other, according to this website I've never seen before. But they have a picture of a jackass next to in shambles and a wise owl next to a shambles. So I think the question is settled.
So I guessed right.
Yeah. Okay. Again, sorry for wasting your time edition. McCain, at least he's not the president, huh?
Yeah, we can be thankful for that. I mean, whenever you want to really rail against Obama, just remember, it could have It could have been McCain or it could have been Romney. Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you, do you think that the guys in charge of the American empire, is it that the Democrats just have a much different kind of opposite sort of policy than the Republicans? Or is it more or less consistently the same policymakers, but they're just complete idiots and have no idea what they're doing? Or is it a grand conspiracy to simply smash every society in the region and try to get them all to kill each other? Or what is going on over there? Because it doesn't seem to make... It sure looks like a shambles to me.
You have to look at it, I think, person by person, because I think there are differences within the Republicans and within the Democrats. But I think the Democrats may be a little more sensitive to the idea that the Americans are sort of sick of sending troops off to foreign lands. Of course, that means they can use drones instead, or special ops, or something more subtle that's not so much in the headlines. So I don't want to, we don't want to make them look too good by comparison to the Republicans. But I think they have this, at least compared to some, like McCain and Graham and Lieberman, who we might as well throw into the Republican Party. Versus them, the Democrats, I think, are a little more sensitive to the idea that Americans have gotten sick of troops being, bogged down for years and years and years in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. And, we saw what happened when Obama wanted to launch attacks, not even not send troops, but launch attacks against Syria. The people stood up and said, no way. So that was a good sign.
Yeah. Although, I wonder about, it was quite contrary to the media narrative. Although we also had, it seemed like Dempsey and the military really didn't want to do it. So I wonder if they had been for it, whether it would have gone ahead on or not. But
yeah, we won't know. We have to be thankful for what we can get. And that was a shining moment when the people basically rose up. Now, the way I like to put it, and I think we've talked about this on the show before, that it was the people that stopped that attack, that the beginnings of that war, U.S. participation in that war,
yeah.
Not the Constitution and nothing else. Because, right. Obama still thinks he's got the constitutional power to do it if he wants, and that he doesn't even need congressional approval. But the people said, we don't care what you think of the Constitution, we don't want to attack Syria. And so far, it's stopped that. It stopped the attack.
Yep. And you know what? Even if that is oversimplifying it a little bit, it's still a powerful precedent, and it's still mostly true, even if, Obama was hesitant a bit himself, and even if the Joint Chiefs happen to agree with us, it is a, there's no doubt that, the establishment consensus was, a red line, we got to do it, on all the liberal hawks and right-wing hawks agreed and all that, and then what came through, which they just could not deny, was the poll numbers, where the American people were saying absolutely not by huge margins. And I remember,
yeah.
I guess better than anything from that time, I remember the frustration of the cable news anchors, like Jake Tapper going, when we come back, we're going to have an in-depth look at what can the president say to the American people to get them on board for this thing. Like, that was just the only way that they could look at it. It was so frustrating to them.
That's right. The Republicans tried to, macho Obama into it by continually raising the red line issue.
Yeah.
Obama then backed away. Remember, Obama backed away and said, "Well, I didn't set a red line. The world set a red line." So he distanced himself from it, giving him some room to then go with the Russian plan to destroy the chemical weapons in Syria, which of course, and that's happening. I guess to the distress of the Republicans, they would love to be able to catch Assad in a violation of that, and then say, "See, we were right all along. Let's attack." So far, that's not happening. So that's another good thing.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say we keep pointing out all these good things, and so why am I saying that foreign policy is a shambles?
Well,
I guess that's a fair question.
It could be worse. It could be President McCain, and so we can always imagine, how much worse it could be. But yeah, no, I mean, It's true that if Obama had really been determined to start a war in Syria, he sure could have, and he didn't. And the American people's opposition certainly did have a large role to play in that, and that is an important thing to note.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they're not over there, you know, causing all kinds of problems all day long and selling weapons to all sides and all kinds of madness, which, you know, sticking with Syria for a minute here, you know, I kind of wondered whether Obama was afraid that ultimately, I mean, come on, he's not as dumb as McCain. They're both as criminal as each other, I think, but McCain has just got air between his ears, where Obama had to have been thinking ahead that, man, he would really be going down in history as a guy who fought a war for Al-Qaeda in Syria, and that could really be bad. You know, I don't know, that maybe it would be too bad to ignore, you know, when the suicide bombers come to power in Damascus and thanking him for it on TV as they blow themselves up or whatever. You know, I don't know. I think maybe that was part of it, was that, you know, that he's been going along with the arming the opposition all this time. I don't mean to acquit him for it, but I think he's been really afraid to help them win, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you had a good interview, a couple of good interviews lately, both with Gareth Porter and Patrick Coburn, where a lot of that was brought out, right? That it's not really clear if Obama, whom Obama wants to win, or whether he would just wants things to remain in the stalemate in Syria.
Yeah.
Because they do seem to grasp the problem if the Al-Qaeda types prevail in Syria, and we see some really bad things happening there. On the other hand, you know, Assad's not a nice guy either, so I don't know, maybe he's taking the position that maybe that the Israelis have taken, that let things just remain sort of, you know, in turmoil without it being tilted one way or the other. And that maybe they've calculated that that's the best thing, but of course, they're concerned about what's happening in Iraq because, you know, after the U.S. investment there, it looks like, oh my gosh, it was for nothing. Of course, we always knew it wasn't for any good cause. It certainly didn't do the Americans any good or the dead Iraqis any good. But now, you know, you hear people say, we've shed so much blood, or we lost so much blood, men and, you know, personnel and treasure in Fallujah, only to have it now come into the hands of Al-Qaeda. So, you know, how can we just stand by and let that happen? In other words, let's pour more blood and treasure, you know, after what we've already lost, as if that could somehow bring back what was lost. And that's the way people seem to be looking at it. Some people seem to be looking at the events in Iraq. But, you know, like you and I have discussed before, and you've discussed it many times with other guests, the Iraqi policy has always been incoherent. Because on the one hand, we have the Iran being our bête noire, you know, our mortal enemy, Iran, and yet we went into Iraq and did Iran's bidding by getting rid of their mortal enemy, Saddam Hussein, and turning it over to the Shiite. So it was always incoherent.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. Man, that was funny. I was stumbling and stuttering and begging forgiveness for my horrible outro, and then I looked and the microphone light was off. My mic was not even on. So you couldn't even hear. I was too out of it to even turn on the mic so you could hear my stumbling failure of an outro there. Thank goodness Sheldon Richmond, he's a very understanding gentleman. Thanks for bearing with us, Sheldon.
I understand Benadryl is a gateway drug.
Yeah, boy, man, I don't know what they put in this thing, but it makes me stupid.
Yeah, next thing you'll be using is Alka-Seltzer. Be careful.
Earlier, though, there was this feeling in my chest, and I really didn't like it, so I took some Benadryl, and it helped, so it made my brain quit working, but it made my lungs work better. So it's a compromise there. And you guys have to suffer either wheezing or incoherence maybe a little bit of both, you know. But it's not up to you. It's up to me. All right. So we were talking about Iraq and how, well, it was really stupid what they did there, right? I mean, or I don't know. Do you think that they deliberately thought that, like, yeah, we'll make a majority Shiite Arab country in the center of the Sunni Arab world, and that'll cause them to all hate each other, man. That'll set up some dominoes and some excuses. Or they just really thought it would be easy, or what?
You know, I wish I knew. I really can't get myself inside their heads, and maybe that's a compliment to me that I can't think the
way. Yeah, exactly. Come on, Sheldon, your inner madman has got to explain this.
I try to pretend I'm Richard Pearl, but it just doesn't work. Or Rumsfeld. You know, the only thing that would make sense is if they had, you know, a regime change in Iran next on the agenda. But, you know, that doesn't strike me as quite likely, because that's a huge job, obviously, and I just don't think they were figuring that, you know, we then move on to Iran and overthrow them, or even that we somehow, they couldn't possibly believe that sanctions were going to cause the Iranian people to rise up and overthrow the regime. I mean, surely they didn't believe that, because who could possibly believe that? So I don't know what they were thinking. I think it was play it by ear, and I think Eric said this the other day. I was just listening to it yesterday, but it was within the last week. That they improvise, right?
It's all ad hoc.
They make it up as they go along, right? And it's somewhat determined by what they did last, but the last move was determined was just an improvisation based on what they did previously. So I think we're wrong to look for some grand strategy. I don't think they think like that, and I think Obama has carried that on. I mean, in a sense, he was, he was stuck with it, and even though he wanted to keep troops there for whatever the reason, I don't know. Of course, you know, I don't believe he was ever really against the Iraq war anyway. Gates might give us some reason to suspect that in his new book, but also. You know, you'll recall that during the election, the primaries against Hillary, he was asked, would he have voted against the authorization for the use of force against Iraq under Bush? And he said, if I'd been in the Senate, I don't know how I would have voted. That didn't get a whole lot of attention. Now, Bill Clinton tried to make a big deal of it. That was part of a fairy tale that Bill Clinton complained about when his wife was getting beaten up. But that was a very telling remark. He's not he wasn't principled. An anti-war person, you know, it sounds funny to even say that these days, but there he is confessing that, you know, for all the bluster he made about being one of the only ones who opposed that resolution on force, he says he doesn't know how he would have voted had he been back in the Senate in those days. So, you know, I don't know what the heck's going through their minds. I think he wants to get through his term and have things kind of look good, so that his legacy is secure, and, you know, otherwise leave it to his successor.
Right. Yeah, that's what Bush said, too, and they asked him about, you know, well, what do you think the end of the Iraq war will look like? And he said, you'll have to ask some other president, because it ain't going to end on my watch, man. I'm just staying until time runs out for me, and it'll be somebody else's problem, like Lyndon Johnson, too. I will not accept another 4 years, because then this war might have to end in total failure while I'm here. I don't want that. I'll be in Texas. Let Nixon take the heat for it.
So I guess if we want to be really charitable, we can give them both credit for realizing that the U.S. can't dictate events there. I mean, the U.S. can kill a lot of people and get a lot of people killed, including Americans, and create a lot of destruction and havoc, but they don't seem to suffer really. Maybe some of his advisors did, Bush's advisors, but the two of them don't seem to have suffered under the delusion that they could actually micromanage events there. So that actually is something to say in their favor. Now, they didn't pull out and totally, you know, get out of there, and Obama didn't until he really had to. But at least they seemed to understand that they just needed to sort of manage it until they got out of office, because there's no way they could fix things in any sense.
Well, I wonder if I had my own think tank up there or whatever, maybe they'd have to consider me a genius, because I would argue that, hey guys, what if we made a real peace with Iran, and then that way that could completely neutralize all the different messes that we're in. It won't matter that we accidentally fought a war for them in Iraq. Like, this is the second place alternative to regime change in Tehran. How about that? Just make friends out of these guys, and it won't matter that you helped them out in Iraq. It won't matter that their allies are in power in Damascus or in southern Lebanon either, because they're friends of ours anyway, so who cares? It'll be just like the old days, only without having a complete and total sock puppet dictatorship. We'll just have a friendly and mostly compliant government over there. They would go along with an offer like that if the Americans were sincere about it. And then that turns, and then we can lord that over the Saudis all day. We can do whatever we want. We won't be so dependent on them anymore because we'll have our friends the Iranians back and all of that, right? Like, I could be a complete, as evil as a sociopath as I can try to be, you know, like I wrote for Foreign Affairs or something like that, what we should do over there. Brilliant. We'll befriend our enemies. Right? Why not?
I think it is a brilliant stroke, and I wish they would do that. He seems ambivalent. Like, he... at times there are signs he wants to do that, and other times, because he's getting pressure from the other side, from AIPAC and from hawkish elements of the Democratic Party, not to mention the Republicans. So I think that's why the message is so mixed, but I think that is a very good idea.
I mean, Buchanan wrote one saying we ought to outright ally with Iran the same way we allied with Stalin against Hitler. Go ahead and ally with Iran against Al-Qaeda. That'll help wipe them out, man. The Iranians, they know the region. We'll arm up Hezbollah against him, I guess, now.
Yeah,
speaking
my only fear
of switching
go,
sides
go,
back and forth.
My only fear is they'll go too far the other way and actually get actively involved in that instead of just staying out. But I agree. They should sign some papers with Iran so that there's now this declaration of friendship and open trade and tourism. That would be wonderful. Of course, Netanyahu and the rest of the Israeli government will be upset because then they can't use Iran as an existential threat, which is very useful that way. But how are they going to claim Iran as an existential threat if it's friendly with the United States? So, so that's one reason why he can't fully embrace that, even if he does glimpse the wisdom of it.
Right. Yeah, wait, why are we sending F-16s to Israel again when they don't have any enemies that aren't friends of ours, or we don't have the influence to protect them? Oops.
Well, that's right, and you know, the Israeli military, as we know, is not enthusiastic at all about a conflict with Israel and with Iran. They don't seem to see Iran as an existential threat. I saw Steve Clemens on TV, I think earlier this week, tell Andrew Mitchell or somebody that the Israeli intelligence are telling Netanyahu that there's been a sea change in Iran, that Iran is not this threat, if it ever was. It's not a threat now. Netanyahu, you know, doesn't want to believe it and can't say that because it's too useful. See, I'm not sure I don't know if they'd really want regime change in Iran, you know, to bring back to have a Shah type that was friendly with Israel, because then you've lost Iran as an existential threat, which is very useful because they try to use it to take people's minds off the Palestinians and what they're doing to the Palestinians and these bogus talks, which, of course, the Obama administration is just playing right along with. So they, in a sense, they need Iran, and that's why I think they won't like anything which says to the world, hey, Iran, it can be a normal country. It doesn't mean it's a libertarian country. It doesn't mean the government's the kind of government any of us want to live under. Even a limited government, libertarian, isn't going to want to live under the supreme leader. But that doesn't mean there needs to be a Cold War, or a covert war, or a proxy war, where we aid and prompt terrorist groups to go into Iran and do bad things, blow things up, or help or encourage Israel to kill scientists, or any of that stuff. We can be friendly and still not like think the regime is a good regime, because I don't think the American regime is a good regime, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. But you know, that doesn't mean it should be war.
All right, and now, in the last couple of minutes here, talk to us about Egypt. What's the future of America's relationship with the government there, do you think?
Well, yeah, I don't know what the future is. I mean, that's something I talked a little bit about in the piece. I think that does expose the American policy for how bad it is. I mean, what possible reason does the U.S. Well, I can name the possible reasons. I shouldn't put it that way. You know, you might wonder, why is the United States siding with this, you know, this basically military dictatorship that overthrew an elected government, is now, you know, once it's going to finally try Morsi, the president that they knocked off, as making the Muslim Brotherhood, declaring it illegal in a terrorist group, and then cracking down on people's civil liberties if they have sympathy for Morsi. With the Muslim Brotherhood, why is the U.S. Taking this stance when it claims to be for democracy? And won't even call it a coup, because legally a coup, if it was a coup, it would require the U.S. to cut off the $1.5 billion of military aid that Egypt gets every year. Well, there are a couple of reasons. I mean, the U.S. has never liked independent, non-aligned countries in the Middle East or anywhere else. Right? They want those countries dependent on the U.S. and not doing anything that U.S. leaders believe is contrary to what they call American interests, but we know what that means, the interests of the ruling elite in the military-industrial complex. So they must see, as they long have seen, the Egyptian military is the safest way to keep Egypt in the U.S. camp. And related to that, of course, is that Egypt has this peace treaty with Israel, which was engineered by Jimmy Carter in 1978. And so Egypt has done Israel's bidding in not doing too much to support the Palestinians, and particularly Gaza. So the U.S., under pressure from Israel, doesn't want to do anything to alienate Egypt. You know, I guess one reason they were worried about Morsi was that, it's possible that he wasn't going to carry out the terms of the peace agreement anymore.
Right. I'm sorry we ran out of time on that. That's a big subject to bring up right at the end of the show there, but we're out of time. But we'll talk again soon. Thanks very much, Sheldon. Appreciate it.
Okay, have a good weekend, Scott. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody, that's the great Sheldon Richmond from the Future Freedom Foundation. We'll see you Sunday morning on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. ScottHorton.org.